Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I want to talk this morning about a koan. It's called Manjushri and the Woman in Samadhi. Come on. And it's case 42 of the Gateless Gate Koan Collection. And I'm also going to talk about a trip to the Art Institute. I was up in the office on Friday. And there was a copy of our new, most recent newsletter there, and there's a blurb in there for an upcoming koan workshop. And I was reading it, and it had this great description. It said, "Despite their reputations for being quite challenging, koans can be powerful and fun when once we learn to enter them without too much fuss." And it went on to say, "We can practice dynamically with the koans to enhance our lives, to deepen our practice, and make our moments more fruitful." So I thought that's a really expansive view of how to work with koans. And this is what I like about koans, actually. I like that you can sort of, you know, hold them up to the light and turn them. And every time you turn them, you kind of see something different in them. And, you know, something seemingly unrelated might happen, and all of a sudden you see the koan completely differently, or the koan informs what you're seeing. So that's what I like about koans. So this one is Manjushri and the Woman in Samadhi, and the first character that we're going to meet is Manjushri. The statue on our altar is a statue of Manjushri, and he's the Bodhisattva of wisdom. He's the being in the Buddhist pantheon who personifies or represents great, great wisdom. The translation I'm going to use is from the Hidden Lamp, Stories of 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. We're using that book for a study group this fall. That's terrific. So here's the koan. It's almost like a folk tale. It starts out long ago, once upon a time, in a galaxy far, far away. It said, "Have fun." Long ago, Manjushri went to a gathering of Buddhas. By the time he arrived, all had departed except for Shakyamuni Buddha and a woman who was seated in a place of highest honor next to the Buddha, deep in meditation. Manjushri asked the Buddha, "Why can this woman sit beside the Buddha when I cannot?" And the Buddha replied, "Just bring her out of samadhi, bring her out of deep meditative concentration, and ask her yourself." So Manjushri circled the woman three times, and he snapped his fingers, and he raised her up to the Brahma heaven, and he employed all his supernatural powers, but he was unable to bring her out of samadhi. And the Buddha then said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris wouldn't be able to bring this woman out of samadhi. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges River, there's a bodhisattva called Delusive Wisdom who will be able to awaken her." At that very moment, Delusive Wisdom emerged from the ground and paid homage to the Buddha. So he bowed to the Buddha. Then he went before the woman and snapped his fingers once. At this, the woman emerged from samadhi. And that's the end. We don't know what happened. That's it. So it's not the usual kind of koan. It has a different form. You know, it isn't a question and answer. You know, the Zen master isn't reaching out and tweaking the student's nose or anything like that. And yet, excuse me, at the same time, it's a mysterious story. You know, what's going on here? What's going on? And the characters in it, I think, are really interesting.
Could you turn it up a little bit, please?
Can we turn it up? Or I could talk louder. Remind me if my voice goes down, because I have a soft voice. Is that better? Can you hear? Okay. So, first of all, who is this woman in samadhi? You know, the story doesn't tell us anything about her at all. You know, we can assume that she's just an ordinary laywoman because in a koan, if she was a bodhisattva or a member of royalty or nun, or one of those wise old ladies selling tea by the roadside, they would have identified her. You know, in koans, they almost always tell you. If it's important, they give you the role of the person, but they don't tell you anything about it in this one. We can infer that she's a person of low rank, because in that time and place, a woman would be. And if she'd been anything other than a person, a very ordinary person of low rank, the story wouldn't make any sense. So I think we can assume that. But if she's an ordinary lay person, why is she sitting in the seat of honor next to the Buddha? You know, that's the seat that traditionally Manjushri would be sitting in, because he's the bodhisattva of wisdom, and he usually sits right there next to the Buddha. So Manjushri's question in that moment is, why can this woman sit beside the Buddha when I cannot? So he's feeling very separated. He's feeling very far away from the Buddha in that moment. The commentaries, koan commentaries, talk about this woman as being stuck in samadhi. And, you know, maybe she is, but I don't think that's the point of the story. Maybe she is, maybe she's not. It doesn't actually say that she's stuck in samadhi. All that it says is that Bodhidharma can't bring her out of samadhi. I think Bodhidharma might think, well, she must be stuck if I can't bring her out. But it doesn't actually say that anywhere in there. So that's a woman in samadhi. And actually, my first question when I read this koan was, what is with Manjushri? What is the deal with Manjushri? We don't see his wisdom in this koan. You know, his wisdom isn't any help to him at all this day. There's a couple of other stories in the Buddhist literature where they kind of poke Manjushri, where he can't do something that he ought to be able to do as the bodhisattva of wisdom. So he gets poked a little bit in some of these stories. But here he's got a blind spot, you know. He can't do something he ought to be able to do, and he sees something that doesn't make any sense to him. So he can't engage with it. He can't engage with her because, you know, because she's totally outside his experience. He doesn't understand what's going on. You would think at this point he would show a little sympathetic joy. It's one of the perfections of the bodhisattva. It's one of the characteristic virtues of a bodhisattva is to take joy in someone else's good fortune. But he doesn't. And I think that that's part of his downfall in this story. And it certainly doesn't help that he's a little full of himself here. Just a little full of himself. And that moves him away from Buddha. You know. And who is the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom? What is delusive wisdom? Anyway, you know. What is that? Is there a bodhisattva of cranky compassion somewhere? It's delusive wisdom. Deluded about what? You know. Maybe he's a sort of wide-eyed, aspiring, brand-new bodhisattva. You know, he comes from the very bottom of the pool. He shows up from the very end of the line. He lives 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges River, away. So he's way, way down there. So how could delusive wisdom do what the great Manjushri couldn't? There's a couple things to notice about the Bodhisattva of delusive wisdom, notice that when he first shows up, the first thing that he does is he goes and bows to Buddha. And it does not say that that Manjushri did that. So we don't know if he did or not, but we know that this young, aspiring Bodhisattva did, which shows some respect and some reverence. I like that. And even though he comes from a really, really, really long way away, he can appear just like that. Just like that. Buddha calls on him, and he's right there. Something kind of odd happens, and there he is. So even if you are the personification of wisdom, delusion can arise just, you know, in a nanosecond. So last week, I'd been reading this koan and kind of thinking about it, and so it was sort of rolling around in my head, and I was walking around with it, and it was in the back of my mind when I went over to the Art Institute one afternoon. There was an exhibit there that I'd seen in the spring, and there was one particular piece that I really liked. And I knew that the exhibit was closing in a couple of days, so I went over to the Art Institute to see it one more time, because it had really moved me. And so I wanted to see it one more time. It was a piece by a behavioral artist named Marcus Young. He's an artist in residence for the city of St. Paul. So I went over there and walked around the Sacred Spaces exhibit. And I ran into Wesley there. And we walked around. If you see Wesley at tea later on, ask him about the Bodhisattva of Compassion and the guard. It was very cool. But we're on a different one now. So the piece that I really liked by Marcus Young was, it consisted of three things hanging on the wall. On the left-hand side, well, there were two articles of clothing, and then in the middle there was a video screen showing a looping a video that looped about every 4 minutes. So on the left side of the video screen hanging on the wall, there was this beautiful, long, flowing blue robe. And it was very plain. It didn't have any decoration to it. But it was striking because it was kind of translucent and very light, and it had a really long train, you know, that would flow out behind you when you wore it. So that was on the left side. And then on the right side, there was a work shirt. And it had the logo over the pocket of the Art Institute. So it was the kind of work shirt somebody would wear if they were doing manual labor at the Art Institute. And then in the middle there was this video. And the video that was showing was about this 3.5-minute video of the artist 3.5 years ago when he was living. He did a piece where he lived at the Art Institute for 10 days in silence, and he spent part of each day doing one of three things. So in the mornings, he put on the beautiful blue robe with the, you know, flowing behind him, and he did kinhin. He did walking meditation, very slow walking meditation all around the museum, so he could show up, you know, in any one of the galleries at any point. And one of the guards saw me watching the video and said, you know, you can't imagine how slow he was walking. He said, it would take him about 10 minutes to get from there to there. So he was doing kinhin. Then in the afternoon, the artist would put on a work shirt and a pair of work pants, and he would go down to the lobby. And you know, in the Art Institute, there's all those floor to ceiling windows and windows on the doors and all over the place. And he would wash the windows and he'd wash the chrome. And that's what he did in the afternoon. And in between times, he sat in meditation. So they had a blank corner of one of the galleries set up for him, and he has Zafu and Zabatan, sitting cushions just like these, sitting in this corner, and he had a little bell just like we have, and he would sit facing into the gallery, and he would just sit. He was doing meditation. So the video showed him doing each of those three activities and then talking about his experience. And I put a link to this exhibit is closed now, but I put a link to the video on the front of the bulletin. Or if you want to see it, you can just go to YouTube and search for Marcus Young Art, and you'll find it, Marcus Young Art. And so in the video, he explains, you know, that he's that he doesn't do the kinds of art that we often associate with artists. You know, he's a behavioral artist, so he doesn't do painting, and he doesn't do sculpture, and he doesn't do pottery and things like that. So he asked himself, what do I have to offer? And he decided, I can offer myself. And so that's what he did. He offered himself doing these three things during his 10 days. So the video shows pictures of him walking around the museum wearing this beautiful blue robe. And just watching this video, it's a very calming kind of meditative thing just to watch him. And it's also mysterious. You know, you see people walking by him, and he said that sometimes people would stop and ask him questions or kind of gape at him, and other people would studiously ignore him as he walked around. But one little boy came up to him and asked, are you worshiping? Worshiping. So he, which tells you something about the little boy. You know, he's been raised in a religious household, and he caught the vibe and applied it in the way that he understood it. So he asked him, are you worshiping? And a woman came up to him and said, so you are for what? Which is a really interesting question. Imagine somebody coming up to you and saying, so what's your function here? So what do you represent? And it's the same question that we have about the woman in Samadhi, in the koan. You know, what's your function here? What are you doing here? But the artist, it said in the video that he was silent all week. So he doesn't tell us what he did when these people asked him these questions. But I think we can imagine that he just, you know, kept his eyes down and just kept walking. Maybe he gave him a little bit of a smile. Maybe he smiled a little bit at those questions. But he was just offering himself. So that's what he was doing when he was walking around the Art Institute wearing this blue robe. And it was also what he was doing when he was wearing the work shirt down in the lobby doing his work. He said that in doing the work in the lobby, he wanted to do something tangible, and he wanted to do it as a way of directly giving back, he said. And as you can imagine, when he was doing that, people didn't notice him in the same way as when he was walking around with the blue robe. You know, you're watching this video, and you know, first you see him in the blue robe, and then you see him down in the lobby, you know, with this squeegee and spray can, and you're thinking, I like to think that I would have noticed him down in the lobby. I really like to think that I would have noticed him down there. You know, I like to think that I would have noticed the beauty of what he was doing and the spirit behind it. And, you know, the beautiful way that he's maneuvering the squeegee and the water running down. I like to think when I entered that museum anticipating being amazed by some beautiful art, that I would have seen this beautiful thing happening in the lobby. You like to think that. And there is an element of religious offering to what he's doing. You know, here we would call it practice. We had a one-day retreat here yesterday, and in the afternoon, we do a lot of meditation, a lot of sitting, and then in the afternoon, we have a period of work practice. And while we're doing the work practice, the idea is to keep your zazen mind, you know, to keep that meditative mind, so that work practice is exactly the same as zazen mind. So we can do the work in a way that isn't any different from the meditation and the cushion. And so the fact that he's doing that work and the way that he's doing that work are this, they're not only a beautiful offering, but he's also accomplishing the first of the bodhisattva vows, right? The four bodhisattva vows. The first one is, beings are numberless. You see all these numberless people walking into the museum. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. I vow to help them. And the way that he's helping them there in the lobby is so subtle that I think a lot of people probably didn't notice it. But at the same time, he's clearing away the smudges, you know, and he's helping them to see. So it's a beautiful offering. And then in between times when he wasn't walking or working, he was sitting in meditation in the gallery, and at that same time, he was presenting himself, just like we do in zazen and in seated meditation. We present ourselves in a no-self kind of way. You just sit down and you go, here it is. This is it. You know, without any overlay of blue robes or important work, you know, we just sit down. And this is it. We want to add something to it. You know, we want to add something to that. And if you do enough zazen, if you do enough sitting, and this may just take you 10 minutes of sitting, but at some point when you do sitting meditation, you will ask yourself, so this is for what? What? What am I doing here? What's this for? And, you know, when that thought does come up and we start thinking that, we can do what he presumably did when people asked him that question. We can just kind of smile and go right back to our meditation. So the woman in Samadhi was in a place where Manjushri couldn't have a conversation with her, and he couldn't bring her out of deep Samadhi, and none of his usual methods worked because he couldn't fathom her. He could only see her in a way that that related to him. You know, he looked at the cushion and of her, where she was sitting next to the Buddha, and all he saw was this Manjushri-shaped hole, you know, where he should have been. And you get the sense that if he had walked into the Art Institute with a friend, and the friend had pointed at the window washer and said, that is my favorite piece of art in the museum right here, he would have thought, you know, you're making a joke, or you're being ironic, or that this was some kind of performance art that he didn't understand. You know, or something. And, you know, Manjushri has a deep appreciation for art. He really does. It's just that even though he's walking into the art museum, he doesn't expect to see art right there, and so he doesn't see it. And in his not seeing it, even after it's been pointed out to him, that it not only puts separation between him and the art, but it also separates him from the person who pointed it out to him. You know, when you think somebody's kidding you or being ironic, you're not close to them anymore. So in that instant, you know, he said, in that instant, he separated from the window washer, he separated from the person next to him, and all he can see is what he doesn't have. He doesn't have an appreciation. So when Manjushri saw the woman in this unexpected role, I think his mind just stopped. And for all his wisdom, he couldn't talk to her. He couldn't get her out of samadhi. All he could see was himself separated from the Buddha. But delusive wisdom, on the other hand, when delusive wisdom walks into the Art Institute, he's like a little kid. Or maybe he's like the character of the fool. So he walks in and his friend shows him, you know, points over there and says, look, there's a really cool art exhibit. And delusive wisdom, you know, runs over there and gets down on his haunches and looks, and he goes, you know, wow, look at those soap bubbles. Look at that squeegee go. Look, I can see right through that glass. You know? And he doesn't know enough to question whether it's art or not. And he also doesn't know enough to question whether he's cool enough to see this art. You know, you point it out, and it's just like when Buddha says to bring the woman out of samadhi, you know, delusive wisdom just says okay, and you point the art out to delusive wisdom, and he just goes okay. And not only that, but if you come back to the Art Institute the next day, the next morning, with delusive wisdom, and you go upstairs and you see the artist walking around in the blue robes, delusive wisdom is going to go, hey, there's the window washer. There he is. So he is deluded. Delusive wisdom is deluded. But there's something pure and beautiful about it. And so at that moment, he's very close to the Buddha, you know. At that moment, when he went over and got down on his haunches to look at the artist, you know, he's bowing. He's bowing to the Buddha. So, if we can walk into that art museum, right, and we can see the window washer's offering, if we can even notice the window washer's offering, and we can receive it with an open heart and see it, see what it is. Or if we can walk around in our usual lives, if we can walk around uptown wearing the beautiful blue robe, the metaphorical beautiful blue robe, and not be pulled one way or another by other people looking at us and going, ooh, she looks really deep. Wow, I feel calm just looking at her. Or, if we can walk around uptown wearing our work clothes and be in the same place as when we're walking around wearing the blue robe. If we can be on the cushion when we're doing either of those things, then we're really close to Buddha. Then we're sitting right next to Buddha. We're on the high seat. We're on Manjushri's seat. We're sitting in the seat of wisdom. But don't take yourself too seriously, because keep in mind that just in a nanosecond, delusive wisdom can be right there. It can arrive at any moment. Which might be a good thing, because when you see delusion, that's when you know that you're off. And when you know that you're off, that's when you know that you've moved a long way away from Buddha. That instead of you sitting there on the cushion, all there is this sort of empty cutout of you. And when you can see that, that's your ticket back to your seat. That's what will bring you right back there. So that's what I thought about this week, last week when I went to the art museum and I had that koan rolling around in my head. I wonder if anybody else has any ideas about that koan, or the art museum, or if anyone has an experience with delusive wisdom, perhaps. Hi, yeah.
I came in a little late, so why did he want to wake her up and talk to her?
Why did he want to? Because Buddha said, "Why don't you?" He walked in, and Buddha's sitting there. And in the seat that Manjushri... He walked in late, by the way. Did you notice that? Everybody else was gone. And he walked in late. And there was somebody else sitting in the seat that he was used to sitting in. And she was this sort of nobody. And he said, "How is it that she can be that close to Buddha and I'm that far away?" And instead of giving him a direct answer, Buddha did what Tim actually would do, what our teacher actually would do. You know, I've gone into Tim before and asked him kind of whiny, obnoxious questions, you know, and he would never just say, "Well, you know, you're an idiot." You know? He would usually ask a question right back. So that's what the Buddha did. Anybody else?
That deep
samadhi. It's deep meditative concentration. So, you know, the idea of, and I think Manjushri thought, well, she's stuck there. And I don't even understand the idea of being stuck in samadhi. I have kind of the opposite problem, usually, you know. I don't even know what that means, being stuck in samadhi.
Isn't that also the delusion?
It is absolutely delusion. Yeah.
So I'm stuck on why the Buddha would ask to get her out of samadhi.
Sorry, go ahead.
And I'm wondering, it seems like there's an assumption here that the Buddha is like infallible here.
Mm-hmm. The Buddha's just asking him. You know? You're wondering about that. Ask her yourself. Well, he's not going to be able to ask her until he can bring her out of samadhi, is he? And
he's not very patient.
Who isn't? Buddha or Manjushri?
Like he could just wait so she's ready to be out by herself.
Yeah. I know. There were a lot of empty seats at that point, right? He could have leaned over and rung the bell, you know. But all he could see was that, hey, that's my seat over there. I'm supposed to be sitting there. Wait a minute. You know, you can almost see the pout.
It's like he's 13 years old.
I know. Where is the sympathetic wisdom? You know, of the four perfections is equanimity, sympathetic joy, and compassion, and loving kindness. I think sympathetic joy is the hardest one. You know, feeling joy in somebody else's good fortune or somebody else's accomplishment. I think that's really hard. And so I sort of... It sort of makes me a little happy that the bodhisattva of wisdom can't even always manage it. I started off with this koan being a little put out with Manjushri. But by the end of the week, I was a little grateful to him.
It seems like the appearance of delusional wisdom is more for Manjushri's benefit than the woman's.
Oh, yeah.
Appearance meant to get Manjushri on the Kali bus.
Delusive wisdom was there to get Manjushri on the Kali bus. I like that a lot. You know. And, you know, it arose from himself. You know, you could say that delusive wisdom rose right out of those far reaches of himself. It's not so far away in some of us, but for him, it's pretty far away.
Do you think delusive wisdom could also be just another aspect of Manjushri himself appearing there?
Yeah, because with a different mindset, you know, you think you could have.
As soon as you know you're deluded.
Yeah.
You come centered wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hope.
And at that point, it would have been okay that somebody else was sitting on his seat. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. Would have been all right. No problem.
Is there any more meaning there since it's the one? And how, you know, where do we receive that?
Yeah, I think it makes her more ordinary. It makes her, it lowers her rank, certainly, in that time and place. I thought a little bit about her being invisible, you know. One thing you find out, I don't know what age you hit it at, but certainly by my age, if you're a 60-year-old woman, it's one of your superpowers. You can become invisible at any moment. You know, you can just be invisible to people and they don't see you, which I actually like. But, you know, you can be waiting in line somewhere or just walking on the street and nobody sees you. Nobody sees you.
I think the same is true for that. My interpretation of it when I saw it was really different. Like, I was focused on how he was showing that when you're working in a service position, you're invisible. Mm-hmm. And you're not invisible out of choice, though. Especially, like, I mean, he was doing that out of choice because he had the privilege to do that as art, mm-hmm. whereas so many people don't have it. Choice to wash a window, that's just their job.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw it like more as this is like bringing to light an invisibility,
mm-hmm.
And in the same way the woman is sort of invisible and can be seen then too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you learn to look at not just those things, but I mean, you should be looking at it, noticing everything, I think. We're noticing the unexpected things, or you know, after I started doing retreats and doing work practice, the first place that I practiced at, the bathrooms were public bathrooms. They were shared with a coffee house, and so sometimes your work practice job would be to clean the bathrooms. And ever since I did that, whenever I go somewhere like an airport bathroom and I see somebody cleaning those bathrooms, I simultaneously feel sort of this kind of solidarity with them, and I also feel my extreme privilege, you know, but I do notice them in a way that I'll bet I'm sure I didn't before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I take a professional interest in public bathrooms also.
Where did this quote come from, the koan, or did this come from somewhere else?
Yeah, that's tells where the delusive wisdom arose from.
So we have something. Yeah, something Diamond Sutra-y about the 1,200 million lands, innumerable as the sand, which are kind of a symbol of enlightenment. So maybe the one of the messages here, I mean, is that there's always a little bit of delusion. You know, you enlighten them, the Kiliakasms,
So even Buddha, well, there's always a little bit of delusion even in Buddha.
That's very cool. Thank you. Yeah, that, I mean, we could go on and on seeing things in this. You know, I mean, we walk around all week this week seeing this koan all over the place. That's one of the fun things about working with koans. So you have it in the back of your mind, and then all of a sudden, when we were in the gallery, I kind of dragged Wesley over to that thing and said, "Look at this! It's my favorite piece," you know. And while we were watching it, I made the connection. I said, "Hey, wait a minute! That's like my koan."
I was imagining this ideal sort of Ron Howard kind of world that he smiles at the woman and bows and sits beside her.
Yeah.
And by sitting beside her, he's right beside the Buddha.
Yep.
But that's not the way it was. And it is what it is. And by being this bodhisattva of wisdom, he's really a hot seat.
Yeah, he is.
Our wisdom, it means you've already achieved something. There's something that's very static about that.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost begs a trickster to throw everything up in the air again.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
And I think his whole experience was, there's a trickster at work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you're the bodhisattva of wisdom, you're sitting up there next to Buddha wearing this beautiful long blue robe. And everybody's looking at you going, "Ooh, that's Manjushri. He's very deep." Yeah, and it, like Susan said, it's very dangerous. He's in the God realm. You know what happens when you come out of the God realm?
Yeah, that's a reminder to remember beginner's mind.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.